Hello again, and welcome to the American Prison State. I'm Dan D'Amico. This is Lecture 7. Today's lecture is predominantly focused on the moral and ethical implications of producing and distributing criminal punishment in complex society. Admittedly, I got a lot of anxiety and apprehension about putting this lecture together, in part because I am not a moral philosopher and don't traditionally think in these terms. I was motivated to write a tweet that said, I am not a moral philosopher, I'm not even a very good moral person. But I guess that's actually appropriate, because a large part of what I'm trying to say about the bulk of the material dedicated to moral philosophy and ethical implications in criminal justice suffers similar methodological problems as do various other discussions in social science. And in particular, I think Austrian perspectives, again, especially spontaneous order theory, does a very good job at arbitraging some of the problems and tensions that remain unresolved in much of the material dedicated to these topics. Another way to think of this is that a lot of people have reflected upon the empirical and historical realities of certain criminal justice practices and deemed them unethical, and I think rightly so, or immoral, and I think rightly so. However, it doesn't necessarily follow that more moral philosophizing or more ethical philosophy applied to the realm of criminal justice will necessarily fix those moral and ethical problems within the system, especially if the causes of those sort of moral and ethical failures are inherent in the institutional provision of criminal justice services that we have in society, and two, the methodological tendencies that we approach the social sciences of crime and punishment from. And so I think that while a lot of the historical material and theoretical material that we'll be surveying in today's lecture is repetitive and sort of building upon the material that we've been discussing in the various lectures up until now, the goal is to sort of connect a few dots to give comment to those people who are very concerned about having a normative theory of criminal justice and understanding from a moral philosophical perspective the provision of criminal justice institutions in society. To give away my punchline, so to speak, it's not very predictive. To a large extent, the majority of the moral and ethical insights that I think you can garner from the types of research that I'm doing or from applying spontaneous order perspectives to the provision of crime and punishment, it tells us a lot more about what deductive moral philosophy cannot do than it tells us any prescriptive details about how to practically ensure a moral or ethical criminal justice system. So admittedly, the punchline to this lecture is nothing close to a blueprint, but I do think that what we're going to be lecturing on next week concerning transition policies and tactics should be informed by these observations about, in particular, the relationship between, say, promoting social change by means of constitutions versus promoting social change by means of promoting justice in individual cases. And we'll get to that as the lecture proceeds. So first off, again, I'm sort of drawing upon the juxtaposition or the tensions between, say, sociological perspectives of crime and punishment on the one hand and more economic approaches to crime and punishment on the other. The disciplinary or theoretical changes in this field of research, subscribe or commit to a pattern of changes that go in lockstep along with changes in real governance. So in other words, when you read people who are writing about crime and punishment circa before 1800, you're reading people who approach that topic from a holistic perspective, as a social philosophy. So people who read Smith, for example, Smith self-identifies in Theory of Moral Sentiments as a philosopher. That doesn't necessarily mean that he did the same things intellectually as philosophers do today. It's not to say that he's necessarily a always and everywhere deductive scholar. It's not to say that he's always and everywhere concerned about moral or normative implications of human behavior. Instead, the original usage at this time, the notion of philosophy, is merely like anyone who seeks to understand things in their essentialist component. A lot of the way Rothbard sets up his writings in terms of St. Thomas Aquinas and his discussion of like Aristotelian essentialism, that which is in the essence of man. Anyone who was sort of doing that for any topic was considered a philosopher. And so what I would like to say is that at pre-1800, for example, there were groups of people who would write systematically about the topics of crime and punishment, and their material we could loosely call sort of like criminal justice philosophy or political theory attuned to the concerns and topics of crime and punishment. This project, oftentimes people wrote that they were seeking a rationale of punishment, a consistent framework from which to approach sort of violations of social norms on the one hand, and then the responses to those violations of social norms on the other. So the three motivating questions that are often surveyed in secondary literature that comments on this is that the research project was dedicated to understanding what behavior should be subjected to punitive sanctions. Notice that that's a very different way of framing that compared to saying what behavior should be criminal. This is before predominantly the rise of a distinctive criminal realm of the legal system, at least in sort of like Anglo-Saxon Western European experience. What are the appropriate intentions of punishment? And the more modern way of saying this, once you've got the presumption of, say, a state provision of criminal justice services, would not be what are the appropriate intentions of punishment in the abstract, but rather what is the appropriate paradigm of a criminal justice system. So this is the question where most of contemporary literature debating the merits and benefits and costs of rehabilitation compared to retribution, that's where that material would fit in this second question. And lastly, how are proportionate penalties calculated? So again, there's an explicit subdiscipline of criminal justice ethicists or criminal justice philosophers today who talk about proportionality, but proportionality was at the center of lots of political philosophy that paid attention to criminal justice. In fact, what I would argue is that when you read older examples of moral philosophy, a lot of it is motivated by by an underlying or implicit theory of punishment. The rightness and wrongness of behaviors is often reflected with regard to whether or not they're deserving of punishments. Oftentimes, this literature refers to equilibrium and proportionality, so on and so forth. So even though at this time there is no sort of formal state identity tied to the provision of criminal justice, criminal justice processes are predominantly civil. We still get people paying attention to the same structural questions as more contemporary scholars are concerned with today. However, what this does in consequence later, after you get the state's involvement in the provision of defining what a crime is, in determining what paradigm of punishment should be deployed, which is basically like the same thing as saying what technique of punishment you should be using, and then also the state's involvement in calculating sentences. By the time you get the state sort of monopolized and in complete control over these three decision-making processes, because there was no explicit intention to, say, public finance, how we practically and actually pay for and finance operations of justice, you got very little attention paid to those topics later when you actually have a more collectivized provision system, which is to say that the potential affordability inefficiencies or opportunity costs will be harder to recognize and understand in that latter environment. So again, by the time you get through the 19th century and especially this latter half of the 20th century, the sociological perspective presumes the social contract is given, that we had to resolve the state of nature issue, and so the legitimate role of the state is within the criminal justice realm, even though the historical evolution of the state's existence doesn't necessarily comport to that story. But again, whether or not the social contract theory holds merit, lots of libertarians are big on challenging this from the tradition of Lysander Spooner through Rothbard, etc. Whether or not those arguments are correct or regardless, this historical consequence, the fact that you have the state come in and sort of usurp all of the legitimacy claims of punishment to itself, without a unique behavioral argument for the state's role in providing punishment, means that we basically end up with a philosophy of punishment devoid of cost constraints, which is a lot of what people are complaining about in the contemporary discourse, that the tension that exists between, say, retribution as a paradigm of criminal justice and proportionality as a paradigm of criminal justice is this notion that there was no built-in constraint to the logic and application of the retributive paradigm. So, again, another way to think of this is that there's little to no constraint on, say, the philosophical or deductive project of assessing something as being just or unjust from a philosophical criminal justice perspective or the moral aspects of criminal justice. If we come up deontologically with some sort of moral proof that says, yes, the state is legitimate in doling out criminal justice sentences, and yes, these behaviors are legitimate in being criminally prohibited, and then yes, the state is legitimate in imposing these particularly calculated criminal justice provisions, then the question of, well, what exogenous constraints might change that would lead us to challenge that philosophical or deductive proof? In other words, if we do this deduction and we recognize that, okay, stealing a car means that you should go to jail for 5 years, and then there is some good moral reason for that, well, then what we should ask critically is, if the costs associated with producing that criminal sentence of 5 years in jail were to radically change, either for the cheaper or more expensive, how that would adjust the moral proof that we put in place to think critically about the appropriateness of that sentence. If it costs $1 billion to incarcerate someone for a year versus $10,000 to incarcerate someone for a year? Does the moral case for a 5-year sentence associated with automobile theft, is that subject to change by means of that price change? Rarely, if ever, is that concern or the reflection upon the societal costs potentials. In other words, what I'm saying is it's easy to recognize that you would want to tweak your moral proof in that example because everything is equated into financial terms. Well, the hard part about resolving these issues at the social realm is that those financial costs are dispersed across lots of people, and the challenge of subjectivism looms significant. In other words, many of the costs that we articulated in the first lecture of this course with regard to the facts and the empirical realities of the way the criminal justice system operates today, they're not necessarily borne on me or you, but rather they do have sort of more macro level societal effects. So in large part, the same sort of challenges of aggregation that Austrians are often concerned about, linking microeconomics to macroeconomics, is definitely at play in the way in which we approach issues of criminal justice from the individual case and into its more sort of collective implications. Let's move on. So by the time, again, we get through the 20th century, there is a more significant popularity in economic rationality applied to the political process. And so what we get is the Chicago School come to dominance, and we get a more cost-benefit approach to understanding how to manage and plan for the deterrence of crime. So the Chicago model requires a variety of simplifying assumptions, some of which are unrealistic, especially the notion that maximizing deterrence maximizing deterrence amidst the ceteris paribus clause in something as socially complicated as crime is often probably inappropriate. One of the recent challenges to these sort of implications would be the recognition of social networks as a stock of perceived utility and value in the mind's eye of individual actors. So, in other words, your relative degree of power and authority might be very, very different outside of jail than in. And so if you're a kingpin or a major decision maker and powerful, like, patriarch, so to speak, within a prison system, your relative position outside of that gang environment, if you're sort of a lowly gang member on the outside, it would significantly change the way in which you endogenize the associated cost of punishment by means of incarceration. In other words, the model of maximizing punitive severity or maximizing capture it presumes that we're in a fixed environment of the type of punishment that's being deployed, as well as the influences and intentions of criminal behavior. And probably those are really bad assumptions when you're talking about the law insofar as it changes periodically, but also just human decision-making and behavior. And we'll sort of talk about this as we more articulate some of the issues that arise. So thinking about it today, there's this really good article on Cafe Hayek that Don Boudreau put up. In other words, it was titled something very pithy like "Those Bloody Keynesians," and what he ends up talking about is that the model, it's not so much that Keynesianism is wrong thoroughly. The model probably holds some traction in very particular environments. So what one of the major debates have been between, say, Austrians and monetarists have been whether what are the causes of particular recessions, and whether or not they fit the sort of credit model discussion that Austrians describe, or the deflationary stories that more monetarists describe. But presuming for a second that there is a role of, say, inflationary response to deflationary crises, that's a very sort of singular problem and singular response. So anytime a problem that looks similar to a business cycle occurs that isn't caused by a lack of monetary liquidity, the mechanism, the only tool in the toolkit of sort of financial economic experts is to print more money. And so Boudreau goes on this sort of parallel to when we believe that diseases were caused by infections in the blood, the only real ability for doctors to bring about healthier conditions for the patient was to either bleed them out and replace their and or replace their blood. But if you have an ulcer, it doesn't matter how much new blood we necessarily give you, it's not going to solve the problem. Today's sort of financial crisis is an obvious example of this. Like, yes, we're throwing more money at the problem, but we're failing to recognize that the problem isn't necessarily solved by more money. I think that to some extent, the Chicago Beckerian model of crime and punishment suffers similar inefficiencies insofar as it's comparably simplistic, as is the Keynesian model. Everything in a very complicated network of human decision-making, such as crime, is conflated into this single sort of social malady, and its response, mainly punishment through incarceration, is this easy go-to. And so, again, when that problem gets more complex and that problem grows in different institutional environments, we politically respond in much the same way. Increased severity, increased enforcement. And it hasn't necessarily resolved the problem. And so I think the biggest empirical challenge to the sort of standard static Chicago rational choice model of crime and punishment is the obvious facts of the matter concerning our current drug war and criminal justice inefficiencies. In other words, what I would argue is that in contrast to either the sociological or the strictly rationalistic economic approach to crime and punishment, that the classical liberal or spontaneous order perspective of crime and punishment is a much better fit to understand the processes that contribute to the problems that we see in society related to crime and punishment today. And so the difficulty here is articulating what exactly I think is the distinctive element of the spontaneous order tradition that I want to talk about. Adam Smith has this great quote about the notion of moving chess pieces on a chessboard as a bad analogy for understanding society, that the social planner seeks to move those pieces at his own sort of centralized whim, whereas what they must recognize is real human beings have their own sort of wills and intentions apart from the sort of structural plan imposed upon them. I think that this is this difference between the, say, de jure and de facto realities of law versus legislation. These are concepts that are continuously articulated in the classical liberal tradition, from Smith to Bastiat to Hayek to Tocqueville, etc. In today's macro discourse, we end up using terms like formal and informal institutions synonymously with state versus market, state being formal, markets being informal. But I don't think that's actually appropriate. And so what I want to do with this diagram is sort of articulate a more precise explanation that I mean to invoke. What I mean to imply in this Venn diagram is that the informal realm of human decision-making contributes to informal social norms and informal institutions. something which is purely informal without being formal, I don't necessarily think is by default outside the realm of the state, but it most often is. In other words, things like shaking hands or fairness, moral norms, reciprocity, these are things that aren't necessarily codified or articulated with formal mechanisms. Violating those norms or behaviors come with certain forms of sanctions, but they're not as predictable with precision by any institutional form, whether it be your family or your church or any other number of voluntary organizations. Formal institutions, on the other hand, those which are compatible, this sort of middle ground here, those which are compatible and well matching of the informal social orders are not necessarily, again, not necessarily state formal institutions. So this middle category, like an archetype of that middle category of institutions, would be something like sports. They're purely voluntaristic. They are well codified and articulate. They often have precision and traction in quantifiable terms. Now, formal institutions which fall outside of any form of compatibility to the informal social norms, that's where the sort of coercive aspects of state legislation and things which are just totally artificial fall. And so ideally what you want is the greatest level of overlap between formal and informal processes. And so my argument is really that monopolized and centralized authority over the application of violent force in society and violent enforcement of law and order drives these two spheres of institutions away from one another, where your formal legislations are out of whack with your informal legislations. And not legislation, your informal legal norms or your informal social processes. Another sort of a proverbial anecdote about this dichotomy. Pete Betke has this book, Why Perestroika Failed. When he lectures about the material in the book, he often talks about how obvious the notion of property rights are to people across cultures and across generational divides. In fact, it sort of transcends human existence. When people owned pet dogs in the Soviet Union, despite living under a regime of collective ownership of the means of production and from each according to his ability to each according to his need, they still, you're like people who had dogs in their backyards would still bark at people who ran through them. And so at one point, there were a number of transition economists who sort of conceptualized and anecdotally thought of their research program as, how is it that we get our formal state institutions to reflect the informal social norms that the dogs already understand? In other words, with each passing sort of regulation and codification that gets implanted upon a formal institutional or an informal social process, you run the greater risk of being at odds with it, especially when that informal process is extremely interconnected and complex, as economies and societies tend to be. So institutional quality, I think, is often just sort of shorthand for this. In other words, there's a problem and a failure in modern macroeconomics, which I think is paralleled in modern criminal justice scholarship. In other words, our theory of institutional quality is no better than is my theory of pornography. In other words, my theory of pornography is not sophisticated or complex in any situation. It's rather just, I know it when I see it. If you show me a bunch of sort of like things that involve naked people, I can tell you which ones are most people will think are pornographic and which ones are more artful per se. In institutional quality, good institutions are defined by their outcomes, which is economic prosperity, peace, stability, social cooperation, the division of labor, so on and so forth. So when you look at the wealth of nations, why some countries are rich and other countries are poor, you get an obvious delineation between, well, it's obvious that the wealth matches the institutional variance, that nations that have institutions like sound property rights, a common accepted rule of law, decentralized government, effectively constrained constitutions, sound monetary policies, so on and so forth, those countries have economic prosperity, they have social liberalism, they have rights for women, they have high education rates, they have indoor plumbing. I mean, life is hunky-dory compared to places that have, well, no clearly defined property rights, unstable monetary regimes, political predation, so on and so forth. So it's not rocket science to understand, well, institutions matter, A, but then B, good institutions aren't a mystery to us. We know what they look like. The thing that we haven't necessarily answered is how the heck we get them. And a lot of people have claimed that they've answered that problem, but very few people have actually like implemented effective institutional change and innovation where they have claimed a capacity to do it. So in particular, what comes to mind is the simultaneous policy failures of, on the one hand, our military efforts to develop post-war torn nations by means of military occupation. Okay, so the Middle East. Chris Coyne's After War book is phenomenal on this topic. The scorecard of when we succeed compared to when we fail is way out of whack. Basically, the major cases for effective military reconstruction are the cases that prove the rule that planning doesn't necessarily work. There, Japan and Germany, for example, had exogenous factors like cultural legacy, vibrant familiarity with markets. I mean, they were destroyed functioning economies, not necessarily underdeveloped economies that also had war. The second sort of obvious failure that challenges that I would argue reaffirms this formal versus informal matching process as the key to institutional success, as opposed to just, say, an institutional category issue, is aid. We have failed to develop the third world by means of spending regimes. So it's not necessarily about a delicating act between the number of good institutions or the number of bad institutions or the number of market-based decision-making compared to state-based decision-making. It's instead a question of how well particular rules are applied to the informal preferences of the people who they're imposed upon. Another thing that comes to mind to highlight this point is an experience I had in graduate school meeting graduate students who had gone to undergraduate institutions very different from my own. I, as many of you know, went to Loyola University New Orleans for undergrad, where I now teach. Our residential life policies were relatively relaxed compared to lots of schools that I've either visited or spoken to people from. Alcohol consumption laws in the state of Louisiana mean that you're allowed legally to consume alcohol at the age of 18 in a private residence. Now, post-Katrina and in more recent years, most of the schools, in an effort to divert their own liabilities associated with underage drinking, have deemed that the residence halls are not eligible for this form of exception. However, when I was a student here from 2000 to 2004, you could still drink in the dorms. You weren't supposed to be technically supposed to bring alcohol in or out of the dorms in large quantities, per se. Second of all, there was just an informal reality as to various forms of social behaviors on campus. We have a vibrant homosexual student group. Various different Greek organizations were sort of notorious for promiscuity. The city is sort of centered around a cultural heritage of drunken debauchery. So then when I met students who had gone to Grove City College, for example, in Pennsylvania, and they told me about some of the formal policies of residential life and student living on their campuses, I just thought it was so funny how imposing those forms of regulations on our student body population. It, like, as an RA, when I was a student, I would tell you that, like, if you actually tried to enforce a prohibition against, say, things like sex and alcohol in the dorms, you would have needed something like a cattle prod to keep it from happening, whereas it took a lot less effort and energy on the part of, say, Grove City residential life assistants to enforce those policies in a more rural, socially conservative, very Christian-inspired educational institution. So I think that there's two factors or social phenomenon that are indicative of social disharmony or institutional disharmony according to the diagram that I just put up. In other words, the more out of whack your formal legislation is with your informal social preferences, the more severe will be the enforcement and the more probably costly will be those enforcement strategies to keep compliance with it. In other words, in the Becker model, where Becker is saying, okay, ceteris paribus, if you increase the severity of punishment, we should impose a higher degree of deterrence. Well, what we're saying is that there are informal processes that attract and attribute high rates of approbation and social value and financial and pecuniary value to certain forms of behavior, which will then set the sort of rent-seeking capacity as to how much the government's going to likely have to expend in order to bring that into a realm of enforceability. The more people want to do drugs and other prohibited substances, the more the drug war will cost in terms of enforcement. The flip side of that is that that degree and potency of enforcement invokes a reaction, right, a seeking of substitutes on the part of those agents who are subjected to it. So this is where you get all of the sort of interesting cultural norms coming out of the underground economy. Another really great article to drive the point about enforcement costs as a function of institutional harmony or institutional disharmony is a paper by Ron Hamaway, an Austrian historian, in Assessing the Criminal, a collected volume edited by Randy Barnett and Hegel is the guy's last name. So, in Hamaway's paper is on the topic of the imposition of sexual deviancy laws during the colonial period in the United States. So in the earliest part of the United States history, we had all of these sort of disjointed townships that were populated by very sometimes different cultural communities. Some were Puritans, some were more just agrarian, some were Irish, some were Italian, we were a nation of sort of small ethnic enclaves distributed throughout a very large landmass. Well, with the rise of more federal regulation came the rise of a request or a desire to regulate marriage and sexual deviancy laws. And so one of the things he points out is that within a very short period of time, a lot of these townships had to come up with a formal age of consent law that the reality, the sort of de facto of the colonial period was that people were marrying and starting families and engaging in sexual intercourse at very young ages and very sort of out of sync age groups. So like older men would marry younger women. Now, not making any sort of moral or ethical claims as to the rightness or wrongness of those practices, but The reality of the situation was that the enforcement of those laws proved near impossible, in large part because the formal codification of the number selected by the government was often just way out of sync with the actual reality of the practices being performed. So in some real environments, you went from having, on average, people getting married at age 12 to then the next year it being illegal to even have sex with someone under the age of 30, which obviously seems unsustainable from an enforceability perspective. The second part of it is more explicitly on the topics of sexual deviancy. I mean, if we take seriously the notion that homosexual preferences are perhaps innate or as personally valued as, say, sensations of love and admiration for as they are for heterosexuals, well, criminalizing those processes that are sort of tied to people's essential identity doesn't negate those preferences. And so Hamaway interprets the existence of these torturous devices associated to sexual deviancy laws like sodomy, homosexual sex, etc., as evidence of this sort of it's evidence of the institutional disharmony that is driving up the severity with which the punishment practices have liberty to escalate to. So again, on the one hand, you see the severity of the practices take place, which has been sort of our central motivating puzzle throughout the entire course. The entire sociological perspective and economics is focused on, well, why is our system so intensely punitive, and why is the magnitude of our punishment so high today? And I would argue because on a variety of institutional levels, we're experiencing comparable levels of these forms of institutional disharmonies. So the other side of this severe ratcheting up of penalties is the forms of institutional innovation that it creates in the underground network. So scholars like Pete Leeson, Marek Kaminski, and Diego Gambetta have all sort of talked about how prohibition markets affect their capital structure, right? So it's easier to transport small amounts of marijuana, it's easier to transport small amounts of crack cocaine than it is to transport large amounts of marijuana. So to a large extent, the forms of logistic unsavory elements that are tied to drug consumption are oftentimes a consequence of prohibition more so than they are the drugs themselves. We see the same thing in the alcohol prohibition experience. Moonshine consumption goes up, beer and wine consumption goes down. Well, that's an adaptive capital structure, but in much the same way as our social capital and our networked capital and our human capital, they're also going to be responsive to the criminal prohibition. We're also going to try to evade enforcement and insulate or develop institutional forms that preserve that distinction between, say, like us and them, the enforcing and enforcees. So you get endogenous underground enforcement where the institutional mechanisms require a level of secretive communication or signaling that is only interpreted by those members of the in-group, oftentimes violent reciprocity. But again, we should always sort of remember that these forms of violent enforcement are much more functional and constrained in the civil realm and amongst relative equals than they are by the formal monopoly provider of the state. And lastly, forms of cultural approbation, right? So rewards tied to criminal identity. So again, both of these forms of effects, like the extreme social costs associated with mass incarceration on the one hand, and then B, the second category, endogenous underground enforcement, et cetera, I mean, those things promote inequality along the same pattern lines of race and class as most people who are concerned with any sense of social philosophy take very seriously. And so not only in this project do I think that we have a way to morally update or at least define some forms of the planning constraints on our criminal justice system, but we also have a significant like alternative suspect for what's driving the things that we think are moral problems in our society at large. In other words, I don't think it's necessarily capitalism and profit motives and greed that drive social inequality in society, but it's instead a very predictable outcome of the way in which we apply criminal justice institutions in the world today. So what I'm saying is that this aim of the criminal justice system, the essence of the criminal justice system, is no different from the essence of central planning, which is to say that it suffers the fatal conceit as well articulated and explained by F.A. Hayek. And you see the pattern of this criticism play itself out in all facets of criminal justice theory. So everything from the political economy starting point, that we're concerned about state of nature issues, we want to promote social order, we want to promote economic development, so we need some sort of like exogenous rule enforcer. What the public choice tradition, for example, has done, well, not really the public choice tradition, Bruce Benson has arguably been one of the very few commentators to point this out, that there is no real behavioral explanation to link government as an effective solution for state of nature games, especially in the production of crime and punishment. In other words, one of the major concerns of criminal justice processes is similar to all of Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, that you're going to overestimate your own interests relative to other people. So if someone violates your rights, you're going to exaggerate how much you've been harmed. If you accidentally violate or intentionally violate someone else's rights, you're going to underestimate. Again, this is one of an equal and opposite justification for state involvement in criminal justice matters. What Benson points out, though, is that there's no reason to suspect that political agents would be any less prone to that behavioral bias as are ordinary individuals. And so the notion that we can make for a better agency in the administration of criminal justice at the collective level doesn't necessarily hold, and should it. And that's the central thesis applied to the provision of prison systems in a paper I've written on the business ethics of incarceration in Reason Papers. Again, the fatal conceit parallels in the model of criminal rehabilitation. I mean, the notion of being able to make men moral has actually had, arguably and empirically, the opposite effect. The initial explanations for prison riots, the early 20th century was a new time for social science and a new time for certain forms of social institutions, prisons being one of them, and structural functionalism as a social science being another. Now, structural functionalists really liked observing prison social communities because it was like sort of a static sample of people that you could observe and keep data on over a long period of time. Gresham Sykes writes a very interesting book called Society of Captives, and his entire model is very much parallel to this form of formal and informal institutional matching. He's arguing that no matter what, social structures will develop amongst your inmates, even though the system is completely designed to completely eliminate those social structures. The original penitentiary designs were set up to completely isolate individuals, to eliminate all forms of talking. There was mandatory silence. They had bags over their heads when they were sort of forced to interact. But the logistic challenges of feeding, housing, transporting, and dealing with environmental conditions like weather in these earlier periods of time, as well as maintaining the inmates to have some sense of physical exercise required collecting them in group settings from time to time. And even during those minimal engagements with one another, a significant degree of social order would develop and emerge. They would develop, again, their secretive institutions, their codes of reciprocity amongst one another, and form bonds of solidarity against the enforcing guards and wardens. So Sykes's argument was that, well, there are various penal experiences where these informal social norms are sort of left free to develop, and that they often have this unintended but beneficial consequence of promoting social order and keeping hostility amongst the inmates to a minimum. So he points to things like the Australian penal colonies experiences, as well as just relatively laissez-faire facilities that were in existence in the earliest part of the 20th century in the United States. Then he argues that, well, the more totalitarian is the sort of warden's edicts upon that system, the more likely is the extreme rate of tension between those two to erupt into a violent, chaotic riot. Especially when those conditions exaggerate themselves when population is high relative to the logistic amount or geography of the jail system. The role of incarceration in totalitarian regimes, I think, also matches this fatal conceit narrative that Hayek talks about, mainly that, trying to regulate something as expansive, or not regulate, but trying to micromanage the entire economy, as did the Soviet Union or the Nazi experience, you're not going to get compliance with that magnitude of economic and social controls without a comparable increase in the magnitude of the enforcement mechanisms being used. And so the reason why we have concentration camps, the reason why we had the Gulag system, was in large part because of the relative ignorance faced by those totalitarian regimes as to how to actually get people to do the forms of behavior that they wanted, because they were so far outside of the more latent tastes and preferences of the behaviors that the individuals would otherwise be choosing to do. Again, I think that the potency and heightened severity of our war on drugs, the militarized retributive response to drug production and consumption that we experience today, solving addiction is not a matter of enforced prohibition. We've seen comparable levels of crime decline without comparable levels of this severity, and we've seen comparable levels of the severity fail to sort of do anything in terms of actually limiting the costs of addiction. In other words, what I want to argue is that collectively these cases allude to a very simple basic fact that it is difficult to plan to make people better. And that process of imposing those plans of whether they even, especially when they are backed by moral justifications, tend to lead to very challenging unintended consequences, especially when those unintended consequences take the form of heightened enforcement regimes. So, to give another sort of way of conceptualizing this insight, is that the range of social outcomes that you can have in all of society, there's a metaphor or a parallel when you look at, say, the social experience of observing prison communities. So again, in much the same way as Sykes has a model for prison riots that parallels this classical liberal insight about the institutional matchings in society, we notice that you can get a variety of outcomes with relatively similar social institutional constraints. So what you're looking at here are images from the Stanford Prison Experiment. And this book, The Lucifer Effect, written by Philip Zimbardo, was only recently published because for so long he was actually sort of emotionally jarred by the experience. He took college undergraduate students into Stanford University and sort of delineated half of them into being inmates and half of them being guards. And only within 3 days did these normal sort of white bread, well-to-do kids devolve into very hostile, inegalitarian power structures that bordered on violence and they refused to eat. They sort of threatened setting things on fire. The sort of torturous mind games were played involving demeaning behavior, including like refusal for showering and bathing. Again, really, really quickly, really, really bad results with arguably pretty high quality agents going into the model. Inversely, if you check out in the media viewer, I have this sort of silly video from YouTube where these are maximum security inmates in a facility in the Philippines who have found a very enjoyable way to pass their time. This is not the only music video that they've made. They've made dozens, if not bordering on hundreds. The facility used to be plagued by continual violence and drug abuse and gang sort of hierarchy authorities. The reason why they started doing this was actually an accident of the fact that the warden wasn't really a veteran warden. His sister became the governor, and she appointed him because he had no other job. And when observing their morning calisthenic routines and told to think creatively about lowering the rates of violence in their facility, he recognized that during the calisthenic routines, well, everything was relatively peaceful because the inmates actually sort of enjoyed doing it. And so rather than, say, mandating that they all perform this behavior, he just started bringing in dance instructors and finding that the inmates got a lot of satisfaction out of it, started sort of self-enforcing amongst themselves that individuals needed to practice and be routine and high quality. And now they sort of do tours. They can manage larger populations of inmates with gender diversity, even, like, despite the fact that the guy in this video is a transvestite, they do routines now with women's inmates as well. My guess is that the guard-to-inmate ratio, as well as the gender ratios amongst the inmates, you'd be hard-pressed to find American correctional officers who would feel confident in maintaining the same level of social cooperation and cohesion and peaceful association that these inmates are doing in the variety of these videos if they were in an American experience. In other words, again, I'm saying that the potential benefits of matching well formal and informal institutional processes are abstract and nearly infinite in their sort of quirkiness, but also their potentially vibrant economic results. On the other hand, the costs associated with getting that matching process incorrect are also extremely unsavory. I mean, you can literally sort of like degrade human existence into the most depraved forms it has taken. Zimbardo, for example, parallels what he observed in the Stanford prison experiment to what he observes in Abu Ghraib via the news and media. Now, what I think that all of this can tell us about about moving forward with an ethical theory of or informing the way in which we design or implement criminal justice institutions in society from an ethical or moral perspective, I think that the inequality or the ratio of costs and benefits associated with crime, on the one hand, as it exists inter-individually, it has relatively low risks and relatively easy solutions at the inter-individual level, whereas the harms associated with inefficient government largesse in doling out criminal punishments are very, very costly and very, very difficult to fix. And so rather than the philosophical debate of criminal justice ethics being focused upon, well, the same framework that evolved before we had state involvement in criminal justice philosophy, right? Those motivating questions of what is an appropriate crime and how do we administer it and so on and so forth. Those are sort of inappropriate questions of discourse when you presume as given the legitimacy of the social contract and the legitimacy of the state. Instead, what we need to think more critically about is how we would structure our state-based constitutions to avoid the forms of inefficiency associated with ineffective criminal justice institutions. We're too busy caught up saying, okay, this is morally legitimized and this isn't, as far as crime A versus crime B, as far as punishment A versus punishment B. We need to start recognizing more significantly that the inefficiencies of our criminal justice system are endemic in the institutional structures that we use to provide it. And again, I think that statelessness research, by inquiring into arenas of, say, the on this previous slide, where we talked about how the endogenous underground enforcement, secretive communication, violent reciprocity norms, and cultural approbation, we should be looking at those and asking ourselves, well, if there are these creative efforts being made in these institutional environments that are effective at maintaining relative peace and prosperity in those admittedly bizarre institutional environments, then we should think, well, why is it that our state-based systems are failing on those comparable margins? We are about at the 1 hour mark, and so I would like to leave room for questions. And again, next week we're going to be talking more explicitly about transition policies and topics. Another, I think, really good empirical article from development economics or macroeconomics, which is development and macro as it exists today is inherently tied to the literatures on self-enforcing exchange, in large part because not just self-enforcing exchange, but political economy more broadly understood. In other words, when you're talking about developing an economy from conditions of destitute poverty or underdevelopment, you're sort of dealing with a state of nature as far as institutions are concerned. So you get articles like Assume Anarchy by this guy Rajan, who says, well, you know, traditional and conventional economic analysis doesn't do us very good at promoting new institutions where we don't know how to bring them, right? We've tried at the barrel of a gun, we've tried at the barrel of a checkbook, but we don't really know how to grow institutions. The Acemoglu, Johnson, and Robinson, as well as Laporta and Schleifer, have a variety of findings, which Lucy called the colonial origins literature. And the colonial origins literature describes that, well, it's basically an empirical replication of Max Weber's research project, that culture matters, that the purposes and intentions of the human beings that are off and like sort of collectively making this intention to colonize areas matters. When you look at the American colonial experience, it's a sample of people who are intentionally leaving oppressive government, trying to insulate and design social structures that avoid those forms of oppressive government again in the future. They're seeking religious freedom, and they are in they're developing their new society for the long haul. That leads to good economic institutions, is sort of the takeaway of the colonial origins literature, that common law systems emerge in these environments in large part because there is an attention paid to constraining the interests of the state from predating wealth in the process of contract resolution. And so basically the argument is that nations that were colonized by the common law were systematically economically better off hundreds of years later than our nations that were founded by the civil law. an inverse of this, or a complementary insight, is that wherever predation went, right, in the colonial experience, you get a lot of sort of charged dialogue because it's so associated with both the genocidal experience of Native American Indians, as well as the slavery experience in the African continent, and the penal colony experience in Australia. So lots of these instances were plagued by some of the most depraved forms of human exploitation and expropriation. But what Acemoglu, Johnson, and Robinson recognize is that, well, you know, predation amongst civil individuals doesn't necessarily suppress long-run economic development. Instead, what does suppress long-run economic development is predation from the state. And so a sort of loose back-of-the-envelope description of this would be, if tomorrow I wake up and my car has been stolen from an ordinary individual person, I can take steps to protect my car from being stolen in the future. I can buy a car with an alarm, buy a car that's harder to steal, I can get a garage, I can do all sorts of things. If I wake up tomorrow and a government representative comes by and sort of siphons wealth or expropriates my car, I have almost no recourse. And so the one process doesn't necessarily inhibit me from saving wealth in the long run, whereas the other might. Lastly, the implication here is a testament to how robust trade and, again, the informal social processes that are developed through trade and mutual association, art of civil association, can really be. In other words, everywhere that these forms of depraved human exploitation occurred, the ones that occurred in conjunction with established trade routes and common law commercial codes had better, significantly better economic conditions hundreds of years later than did those without. So in other words, yes, the imperfections of human existence are terrible, but the relatively simple process of trade and exchange seems to have proven robust at overcoming it to a significant degree. So again, I think that the sort of classical liberal perspective of institutional harmonies puts focus on solving criminal justice issues by means of comparable institutional innovation, as are many of our development institutions, mainly that it requires engagement and practice at this trial and error of what forms of social institutions will work to enforce criminal laws as opposed to not. I think that puts very strong constraints on criminal justice as a moral enterprise, as an ethical project. A lot of people look at our current system and they deem it unethical. But that's not to say that like more refined or more ethical thinking on the topics of criminal justice is necessarily the right way to go. I think more the majority of our problems associated with the criminal justice system have been a consequence of our inability to recognize the complexities of social interaction that lead to crime or violence more particularly. And in particularly, we've been not good at identifying the unintended consequences caused by those forms of state-based institutions that we deploy to fix the problems of crime. I realized that I said 10 minutes ago that we would start questions and answers, and I was hoping that some of you guys would be typing those into our chat box, but there hasn't been much since Lucas Grisham. Would vices are not crime Spooner fit in here as well? The ERE of crime and punishment. The ERE of crime and punishment is exactly what I'm trying to talk about. Another way to sort of think about this theoretical exercise that Mises develops in Human Action would be to look at Mario Rizzo's work on law amid flux. So Rizzo argues that a lot of our law are the institutional provisions of our laws that are tied to contract and tort law are problematic because they don't admit to the potential for exogenous changing conditions. So what is to occur when we have a very sort of static legislative environment about horse and buggy whip quality or something becomes irrelevant in a world with automobiles. Again, sort of as a exogenous criticism of overly constructivist definitions or approaches to moral philosophy and criminal justice ethics would be to say, oh, well, we've legitimized incarceration as a penalty, but what happens if the price of incarceration quadruples or quintuples or it gets exponentially increased? What do you think of David Friedman's method in Law's Order of coming to legal rules through the basis of efficiency rather than through ideas of what is just? Well, I think that it can be preferable so long as you have common agreement as to what efficiency is, which in so this is what we're going to talk a lot about in next week's lecture, which is that there's a very different process or theoretical project associated with, say, developing an institutional system that accommodates for peace, prosperity, et cetera, from a tabula rasa or a blank slate, right? That's been like half of political economy has been focused on the Hobbesian project, the fundamental and foundational relationships between law and social progress. So I think that even though I'm much more of a consequentialist and an efficiency standard guy at heart, I think that the deconstructivist approach that Friedman's doing at times can be problematic. I don't think Friedman's as guilty of this as is many sort of people in who have tried to work in the anarcho-capitalist tradition since think of themselves as sort of system builders. What would the voluntary society look like? How could things be coordinated? That's an interesting project. I like thinking in those terms. I like thinking in those terms for a very particular reason, though, because thinking in those terms stretches your imagination about the range of possible institutional alternatives that might exist. I don't necessarily think that describing any particular rule regime has a lot of predictive traction. Instead, I think that what we have to do is take that theoretical approach that's been laid out well in sort of both the deontological fashion of say, Rothbard, as well as the consequentialist faction of Friedman. And now we need to add to that an empirical observational approach, a la Eleanor Ostrom, so to speak. How is it that people in environments that don't have our traditional forms of institutions, how is it that they innovate and create alternatives? And then if we understand how those processes are at play, then that would give us an insight into what our informal conditions actually look like. Again, sort of a similar exercise as the ERE, or a similar exercise to the invisible hand explanation or spontaneous order explanation of a monetary currency, right? There were certain logistic features that emerged amongst barter commodities that lent themselves well to monetary standards. What would be the logistic features that would lend themselves well to commonly accepted punishment practices? What would the magnitudes and exchange rates be across those punishment practices? I don't think that that project is fundamentally different from the Mengerian project of applying methodological individualism rigorously and comparatively to understand how our exogenous or imposed formal state institutions affect and especially disrupt the otherwise informal functionalities of a spontaneous legal system. Now, a lot of people have a very difficult time seeing that parallel, admittedly. And I don't know entirely how to benefit their appreciation of this. Can we avoid focusing on self-ownership as the only rational way to move forward in changing our institutions to be moral ethical? We can't have an accurate way to reflect the cost of crime if people do not have the right to exclude, as social interaction is a benefit of civility. Okay, Lucas. I'm not entirely sure I understand how your two sentences are related, but in response to the first part of your question, can we avoid focusing on self-ownership as the only rational way to move forward in changing our institutions to be moral or ethical? They aren't related. That makes sense. Okay. I think probably yes. I think that there's a lot of traction in the sort of class divide and inequality that's being perpetrated in our criminal justice system that you could spend all day listing how unfair our criminal justice system is to blacks, minorities, the youth, et cetera, without necessarily making reference to self-ownership. Whether or not that's going to be an effective means to actually have the forms of social change that libertarians like you or I would want, I'm not entirely sure. But I think that part and parcel with that project of articulating the costs of our current system, people have an expectation that you can well articulate the benefits of an alternative system that doesn't rely upon the forms of inequality that we promote now. Now, what this approach implies and what I think Hayekian knowledge problems implies is that we don't know with full certainty what that alternative system would look like or how their outcomes would approach. And in fact, it would likely be a very diverse system where justice would be operationalized one way in one environment and differently in another. So, admittedly, the deck is sort of stacked against us because articulating those benefits sometimes requires stepping into a predictive role that I don't think the Hayekian framework or the spontaneous order framework well accommodates. We can't have an accurate way to reflect the cost of crime if people do not have the right to exclude, as social interaction is a benefit of civility. Yeah, I think that's right. So what are you actually losing if you don't own anything? Social interaction is a benefit of civility. That is true. So this is sort of this is like a block argument about the justification of discrimination. I suppose that's correct. Though I'm not really sure how significant it would play in motivating criminal justice ethics, unless I'm just misconstruing your question, Lucas. We've got about 10 or 12 minutes left, so a few more questions. Tate Fegley to all participants. Does it seem that informal institutions affect formal institutions more than the other way around? In other words, is it more likely that people's attitudes towards controversial behaviors will cause formal regulation of them, or that formal regulation will form people's attitudes towards certain behaviors? I think that both are definitely true. Implying magnitudes is probably different in different contexts. So, in other words, this is one simplified diagram in probably a much more complicated model of institutional change more broadly. In other words, I think that there's a reciprocal relationship between ideas, actions, and institutions. Ideas, beliefs about how the social world operates, motivates people's purposes and intentions and plans, and the means that they choose to accomplish those plans. Now, those sorts of behaviors at the macro level, lots of individuals doing them simultaneously and interacting with one another, contribute to certain forms of institutions. Now, the outcomes of those processes then update our ideas and beliefs about how those institutions operate. So in that institutional node of this sort of like circular flow, you would have this potential tension between formal and informal institutions. That the feedback affected on institutional quality is driven by this tension or harmony. So my guess is that in instances where you get good feedback and have a channel of affecting institutional change, you would have your informal processes bear more influence on your formal processes. Bad laws wouldn't get promoted by democracies because people would have such strong preferences to like make the democratic system work for them. When you have a democratic system that has good feedback, when the link from people's tastes and preferences to political reality is not disjointed by political inefficiencies. In contrast, when you have a gap in that feedback is when you would have formal institutions pretty much just dictate or bear unintended consequences upon informal processes. So that would be like massive totalitarian prohibitions and regulations that that they more or less completely crowd out the otherwise functionality of informal social processes. Tate, does that well explain your question? Yes, good. Again, I think that another good paper on empirical support for the role of informal institutions is written by Claudia Williamson. She's a graduate from WVU. She's working with Bill Easterly right now. And again, this is very comparable to his whole framework of planners versus searchers. But so what she does is she takes property rights stability from the Economic Freedom Index and she puts it on the left side of the equation and then asks critically which set of institutions, formal or informal. And again, I'm frustrated with the way in which she uses those categories to be synonymous with state versus market, because I don't think that that's entirely accurate. But what she notices is that if you look at data available through like culture surveys, like how much do you trust your neighbors, how much do you like enjoy your society, how much do you think that your society is fair, so on and so forth, reported high index scores in culture are more associated with property rights stability than, say, higher proxy scores on their like legal functionalism, their tort processes, their property rights, etc. So what she's trying to do is challenge DeSoto, who I think is more guilty of Coaseanism from a Block perspective than is Coase. So Walter is very much concerned with the law and economics tradition as giving away the private property rights libertarian perspective that they just want to delineate property rights willy-nilly and then let efficiency take hold after that. And he's like, no, you're like spitting in the face of these sort of legitimate property rights holders. Claudia is making a very similar point as that, but in the context responding to DeSoto. In other words, DeSoto wants to go into a developed world and say, oh, they don't have property rights. Well, let's come up with a receipt for everything that we can find in this society and then give it out to people. Now, in part, we'll see this as an effective strategy in transition economics in next week's lecture, but it does run a significant risk that if you're giving away property titles out of sync with the way in which people naturally articulate those property titles, then what you might be doing is imposing a higher degree of cost and potential conflict than would have existed had you not come in and codified those proprietary rights to begin with. And so again, Claudia Williamson, Informal Institutions Rule. It's great material. Right now, murderers, rapists, etc., whenever released, go back into society and can travel with relative anonymity due to the level of public property and public oversight. For example, in a private society, would a private road owner allow for violent criminals to travel on his roads or shop in his stores? That's what I meant by exclusion. Okay. I don't know for certain, but I do think that to the extent that anonymous transportation of violent criminals, which, again, I think would be a very, 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 very minor concern compared to how many people are in jail, like, right now. In other words, the civil tort process has very, very well-articulated ways of responding in punishment magnitude to someone who is a threat to others compared to someone who is a threat to the individual defendant in the case. And I think the majority of real sort of heinous violent crime would fall in the latter. Like, the majority of criminal agents who commit violent crime are either committing violent crime that has a very functional role in a networked relationship of power and underground society like gangs, or is motivated by things like emotion and vengeance, crimes of passion, for example. So, to a large extent, spending social or collective resources at in protecting society from people who don't directly serve a threat to general populations of people, would the magnitude of that concern is a lot smaller. And so the diverse ways in which firms or contract arrangements could accommodate for that much more lessened market would be infinite, right? I mean, anything from to get certain credit cards, you would have to comply with certain forms of criminal history. So, like, we can imagine entire commercial spaces that were reserved to certain credit-worthy or insurance-worthy agent populations of people. Or you could imagine neighborhoods being delineated as such. And we have this to a significant extent now. So, to the again, this is why I view things like TSA as sort of like obvious and objectively ridiculous, because I have a degree of trust that commercial property owners are alert to that which is in their interest to be alert to. So the people with the best incentives to make sure that people fly safely are airlines and passengers. In much the same way as the people who are most inclined to maintain safety of public shopping spaces are store owners, mall owners, etc. But you see them accomplish that without the invasive and totalitarian regulations that the TSA does. So there's a marginal responsiveness, that they're only going to impose regulations on the population to the extent that those populations stand as a threat. I think that they're probably calculating well that cost-benefit analysis in the world that we live in today. You don't have to be, like, it's perfectly likely that someone in the shopping mall, when you're there, is either some form of violent convicted felon, but doesn't necessarily pose an active violent threat to you while you're in the course of the shopping mall. And I think that we have a very difficult time comprehending those real probabilities for behavioral reasons, for inefficient sort of public finance reasons as well. We probably have time for about one more quick question. Not hearing much. Well, just a reminder that all of the previous lectures, multiple choice quizzes, should be up online. And this week seven, will be up online shortly within the next few days. The PowerPoints will be available for download, and I am still in the process of putting together an additional recommended readings list for the class. Can you speculate on how prevalent incarceration would be in an anarcho-capitalist society? I would speculate very, very infrequently. I think that there are... So one of the interesting political philosophical perspectives is Rawls, right? We'd rather let a million guilty men go free than an innocent be held falsely. I think that that's when if we had the forms of civil liability directed at agencies producing these forms of institutions, you would see a lot more constraint in how they were applied. So incarceration is very costly. And the way in which, if you had these smaller facilities, what they would do on the inside would also be very different. So it's like saying what we have is what incarceration is. We would have nothing like what we have. So to a large extent, incarceration would probably not exist in an anarcho-capitalist society. I'm interested in speculating, though not confident in the sort of like moral proof. But again, this sort of conclusion of the presentation about an ethical support for constitutions over criminal prohibitions, like we should be less concerned about lineating what laws the government should be in the business of prohibiting and enforcing and how. And we should be much more in the business of saying, well, maybe the errors of government in this arena will outpace whatever our concerns are about the social harms of criminal behavior. And in that sense, the more I sort of work on these topics and think about them critically, the more radical I get on, as a transition policy, and again, we're going to talk about this in the next week's lecture, I'm very serious about the notion of supporting an abolition movement regarding incarceration by governments today. That I think that, in order, especially in the forms of advanced democracies, that are subject to the forms of rent-seeking and political bureaucracy inefficiencies that we have today, it's probably a good constitutional practice to perhaps consider stipulating incarceration as a form of cruel and unusual punishment. With that being said, we are out of time for the week. Thank you all for attending again, and for those of you who will be watching on video, you feel free to email me questions or comments between now and next lecture, which will be the closing lecture for the course. Have a great week.